Friends, this week we're going to look a little into the historical background, which is helpful for understanding certain aspects of the Egon itself. You know, last week we looked at the importance of the Egon, and we did a review of the, just a summary review, really, of the major themes or topics of the Egon. How are you, some of you getting along with that? I hope you're having a chance to read some of the Egon, because it'll help a lot to understand what's going on if you're reading the Egon at the same time. Now this evening, we have a handout here. We could have a couple of volunteers to help pass these out. The Egon, unsurpassed preeminence among the doctrinal writings of Baha'u'llah. As you'll see from the heading of this particular handout, this is a passage from God Passes By. Now this passage gives us essentially the basic information really that we need to know to see the Egon in its setting, its historical context. It also establishes the circumstances of its revelation. And the last half of this is the same material that you had last week. That is a summary of the topics within the compass. A compass of 200 pages, it says at the beginning of the second paragraph. Now we'll read this through, and then we have some notes and comments to make about these particular points as well. Okay. Might keep some of these at the back of the room for those that come late. Yes. God Passes By, pages 138, 139. Thank you. There comes some more people. Why don't someone keep a pile of these? Would you give them someone in the back that they can, or on that green table there? This appears in the book God Passes By, written by Shoghi Effendi, where he is surveying some of the literature that Baha'u'llah revealed in Baghdad, in the time that Baha'u'llah was in exile in Baghdad. And he says, "Foremost among the priceless treasures cast forth from the billowing ocean of Baha'u'llah's revelation ranks the Kitab-i Egon, revealed within the space of 2 days and two nights. In the closing years of that period," in other words, the period in which Baha'u'llah was resident in Baghdad, corresponding to 1862, or the year of the Hijra, 1278. "It was written in fulfillment of the prophecy of the Bab, who had specifically stated that the Promised One would complete the text of the unfinished Persian Bayan. And in reply to the questions addressed to Baha'u'llah by the as yet unconverted maternal uncle of the Bab, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, while on a visit, with his brother, Haji Mirza Hasan Ali, to Karbala. A model of Persian prose, of a style at once original, chaste and vigorous, and remarkably lucid, both cogent in argument and matchless in its irresistible eloquence. This book, setting forth in outline the grand redemptive scheme of God, occupies a position unequaled by any work in the entire range of Baha'i literature, except the Kitab-i Aqdas, Baha'u'llah's most holy book. Revealed on the eve of the declaration of his mission, it proffered to mankind the choice sealed wine, whose seal is of musk, and broke the seals of the book referred to by Daniel, and disclosed the meaning of the words destined to remain closed up till the time of the end. Now we'll look at the notes that are related to this first paragraph, and then we'll go on to the second paragraph. There's a few points there as well. The first thing that strikes us is this foremost among the treasures of Baha'u'llah's revelation. And you have noted down further where he says that it occupies a position unequaled by any work in the whole range of Baha'u'llah's writings, except the Aqdas, which is the most holy book, the Book of Laws. So of all the Baha'i books, this is number two. But for doctrinal purposes, it's number one. Not only number one in this revelation, but number one in the whole history of religion. There's never been a book that has explained this much about the nature of God and the holy manifestations of God. It was revealed within the space of 2 days and two nights. Well, you've had a week to read it. How have you been doing? He seems to have revealed it faster than people are able to read it. And I think some of you have heard the stories of the rapidity with which Baha'u'llah revealed divine verses and the power and potency of the circumstances when he did reveal, when he was revealing. He usually excused the people who were with him because the power of it was so overwhelming that people couldn't bear it. And the secretaries did their best to cope with trying to take down some of what was flowing from his lips. 1,000 verses an hour. Extraordinary speed. In a day and a night, the equal of the Quran. There are a number of references about this rapidity with which the Bab and Baha'u'llah reveal divine verses. And one of them is cited as follows, a story. It says, this is from Shoghi Effendi, says, a certain Muhammad Karim, a native of Shiraz, who had been a witness to the rapidity and the manner in which the Bab had penned the verses with which he was inspired, has left the following testimony to posterity after attaining, during those days, the presence of Baha'u'llah, this same Baghdad period, and beholding with his own eyes what he himself had considered to be the only proof of the mission of the Promised One. I bear witness, he said, that the verses revealed by Baha'u'llah were superior in the rapidity with which they were penned, in the ease with which they flowed, in their lucidity, their profundity and sweetness, to those which I myself saw pour from the pen of the Bab when in his presence. Had Baha'u'llah no other claim to greatness, this were sufficient in the eyes of the world and its people, that he produced such verses as have streamed this day from his pen. That's cited also in God Passes By on page 138. Now, with regard to the date of the revelation of the Iqan, which is given here as 1862, there are several passages in the Iqan itself which indicate the date of its revelation, such as, quote, these holy lights have for 18 years heroically endured the showers of afflictions. If you add 18 to the beginning of the Baha'i era in 1844, which in the lunar calendar is 1260. If you add 18 to that, you come out with 1278. And that's equivalent to 1862. And this is where the Guardian presumably has derived the date of its revelation. We mentioned here about this period. It means the Baghdad period, particularly the 6 years following the return of Baha'u'llah from his two-year retirement in Kurdistan. That was from 1856 to 1863. The Ghan was revealed during the time Baha'u'llah resided in an extremely modest residence, which he later designated as the Most Great House, his most holy habitation, out of which, he says in his tablets, had gone forth the breath of the All-Glorious, and from which had poured forth in ceaseless strains the melody of the All-Merciful. And it's this house now which he has ordained as a center of pilgrimage, the house in which the Kitab-i-Ghan was originally revealed. Concerning the prophecy of the Bab that's mentioned here, the Bab specified that the Bayan is not completed and that he whom God would manifest, and I'm citing a letter from the Guardian here, written on behalf of Shoghi Effendi, that he whom God would make manifest, in other words, Baha'u'llah, would complete it, though not in its actual form, but only spiritually in the form of another book. The Ighan is believed to be its continuation. With regard to the Bayan itself, Shoghi Effendi refers to it. That last quotation is from Dawn of a New Day, page 78, the collection of Shoghi Effendi's letters. Dawn of a New Day, page 78. And this is from God Passes By again. He says, peerless, Shoghi Effendi says, peerless among the doctrinal works of the founder of the Babi dispensation. Now notice the parallel. This is the most outstanding, preeminent doctrinal work of Baha'u'llah. The outstanding doctrinal work of the Bab was the Persian Bayan. Now, oftentimes we think of that as his book of laws, because it was, but it contains a great deal of doctrine as well. Peerless among the doctrinal works of the founder of the Babi dispensation, consisting of 9 vahids, or unities, of 19 chapters each, except the last vahid comprising only 10 chapters, this book of about 8,000 verses, occupying a pivotal position in Babi literature, should be regarded primarily as a eulogy of the Promised One rather than a code of laws and ordinances designed to be a permanent guide to future generations. So you see now we have this 9 vahids of 19 chapters, except the last one with only 10 chapters, so there's missing 9. And this continuation, this missing portion that the Ighan fulfills. The Bab himself comments on the position of the Bayan in relation to the revelation of the Promised One. Thus, he says, the previous passage, by the way, is God Passes By, page 25. The Bab says, I swear by the most holy essence of God, exalted and glorified be He, that in the day of the appearance of Him whom God shall make manifest, 1,000 perusals of the Bayan cannot equal the perusal of a single verse to be revealed by Him whom God shall make manifest. And know thou of a certainty that every letter revealed in the Bayan is solely intended to evoke submission unto Him whom God shall make manifest. For it is He who hath revealed the Bayan prior to His own manifestation. You'll find that cited in Selections from the Writings of the Bab, page 104. Now, the maternal uncle of the Bab, who has elicited this marvelous book, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, was one of 3 brothers of Fatime Begum, the mother of the Bab. We have some further details, find them here, that I've collected on these brothers. Take a moment to look at that. These 3 brothers all figure in Baha'i history. The first of them is the best known, is Haji Mirza Sayyid Ali. Haji Mirza Sayyid Ali is known as Khale Azam, the greatest uncle. This is the, being uncles of the Bab, being the brothers of the mother of the Bab. It's been characterized by Shoghi Effendi as noble and serene. He was one of the leading merchants of Shiraz. It was this same uncle into whose custody the Bab, after the death of his father, was entrusted, and who, on his nephew's return from his pilgrimage to Hejaz and his arrest by Hossein Khan, you remember, the governor of Fars, of Shiraz, assumed undivided responsibility for him by pledging his word in writing. It was he who surrounded him while under his care with unfailing solicitude, who served him with such devotion, and who acted as intermediary between him and the hosts of his followers who flocked to Shiraz to see him. This uncle eventually suffered martyrdom. He offered up his life as one of the seven renowned martyrs of Tehran. The other uncles had not recognized the Bab during his lifetime. They had other questions, concerns. Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, who was known as Khale Akbar, the greater uncle, was the eldest of the uncles, and he was engaged also in business with the Bab in Bushehr. You know, the Bab had spent that period with his uncle there on the coast of the Gulf. He says that this uncle, as we mentioned, was unconverted in the ministry of the Bab. He later traveled to Iraq, where he called on Baha'u'llah and became the honored recipient of the Igan. The revelation of this book, in answer to his questions, was followed by his private acceptance of the faith, an acceptance which eventually became clearly known through his open affirmations of the fact in his will and testament. Now, he was accompanied in this trip that he made to Iraq to visit Karbala, to visit the holy places. You know, the holy places of the Imams of the Shia faith are in Iraq, and so that was a place of pilgrimage for Persians. So there were lots of Persians going there. Many of them ostensibly were going on pilgrimage. Actually, they were going to see Baha'u'llah or to visit the ones who knew about that. And the Baha'is could go safely that way to see Baha'u'llah because it was a custom of the people to go on this pilgrimage. So these two brothers had gone. Now, this other brother didn't want to have anything to do with visiting Baha'u'llah, and he refused to visit his house. So he missed that opportunity. He's the younger Khale Askar, he's the younger of the uncles. He was also a merchant engaged with the Bab in trade. And later in his life, he also embraced the faith in the end, but he missed his opportunity then of seeing Baha'u'llah. They both, in other words, embraced both the Bab and Baha'u'llah. There had been a prayer on the part of the Bab that his family and relatives might recognize the Promised One when he appeared. And Baha'u'llah has mentioned this in his own writings, confirmed that this was the wish of the Bab. And for the most part, the Afnan have followed the faith and been very faithful, devoted servants of the cause. You'll see a reference in this second paragraph here to, at the end of the first paragraph, to the fact that the Igan proffered to mankind the choice sealed wine whose seal is of musk. Now, these are references from the Quran, and broke the seals of the book referred to by Daniel. This is the Old Testament. Disclosed the meaning of the words destined to remain closed up till the time of the end. The sources on these are as follows. In the Quran, in the 83rd surah, we find references to the choice sealed wine being given as drink to quaff to the righteous in paradise, and it says that the seal of this is of musk rather than mud. Normally wine would have been sealed with mud, but in some cases this waxy musk was used as a special kind of a seal, and it's referred to here. There are a number of passages from Baha'u'llah which refer to this choice sealed wine. It's mentioned again in the Akdas as well. For instance, he says, "Verily I say, the seal of the choice wine hath in this day, in the name of him who is the self-subsisting, been broken. Withhold not thyself therefrom." And again he says, by the righteousness of God, idle fancies have debarred men from the horizon of certitude, and vain imaginings withheld them from the choice sealed wine. And you remember also from the Actas, the parts that we already have translated, the line, think not that we have revealed unto you a mere code of laws. Nay, rather, we have unsealed the choice wine with the fingers of might and power. Now, Baha'u'llah, in another tablet which is not yet published, says clearly that this wine that's mentioned here, this choice sealed wine, refers to the divine verses of this revelation, the like of which peoples of ages past have never tasted. It is only in this day that we've been given the favor of quaffing this choice sealed wine. And so Shoghi Effendi relates this question of the breaking of the seal and Baha'u'llah proffering this to mankind in this day in fulfillment of the Quranic prophecy. There's an interesting further explanation of Baha'u'llah about the whole question of wine mentioned in his writings. The significance attributed to spiritual wine, in contrast to the wine that men drink, is unfolded by Baha'u'llah in the following words. He says, fear ye God, O people of the earth, and think not that the wine we have mentioned in our tablets is the wine which men drink, and which causeth their intelligence to pass away, and their human nature to be perverted, their light to be changed, and their purity to be soiled. Our intention is indeed that wine which intensifieth man's love for God, for his chosen ones, and for his loved ones, and igniteth in the hearts the fire of God, and love for him, and glorification and praise of him. So potent is this wine that a drop thereof will attract him who drinketh it to the court of his sanctity and nearness, and will enable him to attain the presence of God, the King, the Glorious, the Most Beauteous. It is a wine that blotteth out from the hearts of the true lovers all suggestions of limitation, establisheth the truth of his signs, of the signs of his oneness and divine unity, and leadeth them to the tabernacle of the well-beloved in the presence of God, the Sovereign Lord, the self-subsisting, the all-forgiving, the all-generous. We meant by this wine the river of God and his favor, the fountain of his living waters, and the mystic wine and its divine grace, even as it was revealed in the Quran, if ye are of those who understand. And he said, and how true is his utterance, a wine delectable to those who drink it. And he had no purpose in this but the wine we have mentioned to you, O people of certitude. With regard to the question of the breaking of the seals of the book, this is a reference to the book of Daniel, chapter 12, verse 4. Be thou, O Daniel, but thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. And then he says, disclosing the meaning of the words destined to remain closed up till the time of the end. This is also Daniel, chapter 12, verse 9 this time. And he said, go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. You can read more about this subject of the prophecies of Daniel in chapter 10 of Some Answered Questions, entitled Traditional Proofs Exemplified from the Book of Daniel. With regard to its length, 200 pages, sometimes the friends say, but this is 250 pages. How is it? He says 200. This is the length of the original Persian manuscript copy, which is in Abdu'l-Bahá's own calligraphy, his own hand. The second paragraph of the explanation mentions, as we said last week, about God. It proclaims unequivocally the existence and oneness of a personal God. He names these essential attributes of God. And I have here the letter that I was mentioning to you last week about personal God. What is meant by personal God? It's interesting that Shoghi Effendi has chosen to place this word personal along with God in this definition. And in a letter written on his behalf in 1939, he says, what is meant by personal God is a God who is conscious of his creation, who has a mind, a will, a purpose, and not as many scientists believe, an unconscious and determined force operating in the universe. Such a conception of the divine being as the supreme and ever-present reality in the world is not anthropomorphic, for it transcends all human limitations and forms, and does by no means attempt to define the essence of divinity, which is obviously beyond any human comprehension. To say that God is a personal reality does not mean that he has a physical form, or does in any way resemble a human being. To entertain such a belief would be sheer blasphemy. So in case we had a misunderstanding about what he meant by personal God. And then he mentions here this question of the relativity of religious truth, farther down, fourth and fifth line, line 30 of this particular set here, asserts the relativity of religious truth and the continuity of divine revelation. This is one of the essential features of the Egon. This principle is summarized in a statement to the United Nations Commission on Palestine in 1947, written by the Guardian. You'll find references to this question of the relativity of religious truth in the Dispensation and in other letters of Shoghi Effendi and among his books. But this, I think, is the most succinct and at the same time detailed explanation of this principle. It reads as follows. The fundamental principle enunciated by Baha'u'llah is that religious truth is not absolute but relative, that divine revelation is a continuous and progressive process, that all the great religions of the world are divine in origin, that their basic principles are in complete harmony, that their aims and purposes are one and the same, that their teachings are but facets of one truth, that their functions are complementary, that they differ only in the non-essential aspects of their doctrines, and that their missions represent successive stages in the spiritual evolution of human society. You'll find this cited in the introduction to the small book called Call to the Nations, which is a compilation of Shoghi Effendi's writings prepared by the Universal House of Justice, Call to the Nations. It's just in the introduction, I think it's 2 or 3 pages. I don't have a page number. Finally, at the end of this, we find a sentence starting on line of this paper that you have in hand, on line what would be 58. Well, may it be claimed that of all the books revealed by the author of the Baha'i Revelation, this book alone, by sweeping away the age-long barriers that have so insurmountably separated the great religions of the world, has laid down a broad and unassailable foundation for the complete and permanent reconciliation of their followers. We would want to be attentive to that as we read through the Egon and think about the principles that it proclaims. Now, you know, when you say that this, of all the books revealed by Baha'u'llah, it's saying a lot, because Baha'u'llah's writings fill some 100 volumes. And Shoghi Effendi characterizes these as volumes replete with unnumbered exhortations, revolutionizing principles, world-shaping laws and ordinances, dire warnings, and portentous prophecies, with soul-uplifting prayers and meditations, illuminating commentaries and interpretations, impassioned discourses and homilies, all interspersed with either addresses or references to kings, to emperors, and to ministers of both the East and the West, to ecclesiastics of diverse denominations, and to leaders in the intellectual, political, literary, mystical, commercial, and humanitarian spheres of human activity. With regard to the great religions of the world, I think you perhaps are familiar with different passages here. In one of his letters, Shoghi Effendi indicates that the Baha'i Revelation constitutes the ninth in the line of existing religions. the latest and fullest revelation which mankind has ever known. These religions are not only the true religions that have appeared in the world, but are the only ones still existing. And he names them as, besides the one of the Bab, which is the eighth, seven others: Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. There have always been divine prophets and messengers, to many of whom the Quran refers, but the only ones existing are those mentioned above. Now this is interesting to bear in mind, because we will find that in the Iqan itself, Baha'u'llah refers to a number of messengers that we don't know much about. In fact, we know about them from the Iqan and from the Quran, and there's not much other history available about them, like Hud and Saleh and some of these others. And yet they were full messengers of God, but they don't have any followers now. So they are not, in that sense, existing religions. So there have been many religions, but in broad terms you can say that there are nine existing religions of the divinely revealed religions still. The seven others are Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Then the Bab is seven. Baha'u'llah is eight. Is that all there is here? Oh, and the religion of the Sabians, sorry. Forgot that the religion of the Sabians is before all of these others. Presume possibly that here the prophet of Sabianism was Enoch, but that's not confirmed. Shoghi Effendi said he presumed that it was. This letter you can find, by the way, in American Baha'i News number 105. That is February 1937, on page 2. Now, a little more background about Islam. Islam, it's very important for us to understand something about Islam. There's a lot of references in here. People sometimes, when they first read the Iqan, they say, but it quotes the Quran all the time. You know, why does it quote the Quran and not quote the Bible? Well, it's addressed to a Muslim. And the way they would view, the way a Muslim would view the verses of the Quran, would be much more proof than if he quoted the verses of the Bible, of either the Torah or of the New Testament. And so Baha'u'llah has punctuated his explanation, as was the characteristic of writings of that period, with quotations from the Quran. Now, he didn't need to do that, but he did it also because he hadn't yet declared openly his mission. He alludes to it in the book in several places, that the Promised One is here, that it's coming, and so on. But here he's explaining, as an outstanding Babi, really, the revelation of the Bab, defending the revelation of the Bab to the uncle of the Bab. Perhaps you'll recall, in Advent of Divine Justice, Shoghi Effendi says that, in speaking about the teachers and those that want to arise to serve the faith, all of us really, they must strive to obtain from sources that are authoritative and unbiased a sound knowledge of the history and tenets of Islam, the source and background of their faith, and approach reverently and with a mind purged from preconceived ideas the study of the Quran, which, apart from the sacred scriptures of the Babi and Baha'i revelations, constitutes the only book which can be regarded as an absolutely authenticated repository of the Word of God. They must devote special attention to the investigation of those institutions and circumstances that are directly connected with the origin and birth of their faith, with the station claimed by its forerunner, and with the laws revealed by its author. Now, you'll understand more of this, if you haven't already studied it, as we read a few other passages here regarding Shia Islam. Notice that he says that the Quran, outside of the writings of the Bab and Baha'u'llah, is the only repository of authenticated scriptures. The Bible is considered divinely inspired, but is not wholly authenticated scripture, because much of the Bible is accounts, what we would call pilgrim notes, about events going on. No? Someone saying, they were inspired to write this down, but there are contradicting reports and so on. It's all been collected, but it's of a quality that's very different from the Quran, which is actually the revealed words of God, which have been memorized and noted down from Muhammad's own revelation. Islam, Shoghi Effendi says in another letter, attained a very high spiritual state. But Western scholars are prone to judging it by Christian standards. One cannot call one world faith superior to another, as they all come from God. They are progressive, each suited to certain needs of the times. And he says again, Mohammedanism is not only the last of the world religions, but a fuller revelation than anyone preceding it. This is a challenge to us to accept, that coming from the West, having been perhaps many of us from Christian background, that Islam is a fuller revelation of God's purpose than Christianity. Far superior in many of its aspects than Christianity. Now at the present time we've seen the degeneration of both Christianity and Islam, and the West unfortunately is becoming more and more familiar with Islamic teachings through the mouth of Imam Khomeini and other poor representatives of what it stands for. The Quran is not only more authoritative than any previous religious gospel, but it contains also much more. Ordinances, teachings, and precepts, which taken together constitute a fuller revelation of God's purpose and law to mankind than Christianity, Judaism, or any other previous dispensation. This view is in complete accord with the Baha'i philosophy of progressive revelation and should be thoroughly accepted and taught by every loyal Baha'i. You'll find that cited in Unfolding Destiny, page 432. Again, the Guardian urges the friends to make a thorough study of the Quran, as the knowledge of this sacred scripture is absolutely indispensable for every believer who wishes to adequately understand and intelligently read the writings of Baha'u'llah. So if thus far we haven't made any study of the Quran, we should start to think about it, because this is absolutely essential, indispensable, if you wish to adequately understand and intelligently read Baha'u'llah's writings. Then in another letter he says, it's certainly most difficult to thoroughly grasp all the surahs of the Quran, as it requires a detailed knowledge of the social, religious, and historical background of Arabia at the time of the appearance of the Prophet. So then you add a whole other scope of studies, Islamic studies, to your curricula here. The believers cannot possibly hope, therefore, to understand the surahs after the first or even the second or third reading. They have to study them again and again, ponder over their meaning, and with the help of certain commentaries and explanatory notes, as found, for instance, in the admirable translation made by Sale, endeavor to acquire as clear and correct understanding of their meaning and import as possible. This is naturally a slow process, but future generations of believers will certainly come to grasp it. Now, we are the future generations already. Well, maybe not yet, because we haven't grasped it yet, but I don't know how many of you have studied the Quran. For the present, the Guardian agrees that it would be easier and more helpful to study the book according to subjects and not verse by verse, and also in the light of the Bab, Baha'u'llah, and Abdul Baha's interpretations, which throw such floods of light on the whole of the Quran. That's U.S. Baha'i News, number 134, pages 2 and 3. Now, you know that Islam split very early into two groups, the Sunni and the Shia, main divisions of Islam. And the Shia have to do with the family of the Prophet as being his descendants, first Ali, who was married to his daughter, and then their descendants as the rightful successors of Muhammad as the center of the faith after him. And the Sunnis believed that it was the way of the people that they should elect their leader, and were really, in a sense, the usurpers of the authority of the covenant of Muhammad, which in retrospect, although it was not so clear at that time, but certainly it's clear through the writings of the Bab and Baha'u'llah, were the rightful appointed centers of the Islamic faith. And that is the 12 Imams that are believed in by the Shia Twelvers. Shia includes a number of sects. Some of them only believe in 5 Imams. Some believe in 7 Imams. There's variations on this. But the largest group is the one that believes in 12 Imams. And this is important for us to understand, because the people believed the Bab to be the return of the 12th Imam. His name was the Qa'im, his title was the Qa'im, or he who ariseth, and implied in that, from the family of Muhammad. In other words, it should be a descendant of Muhammad, should be a Sayyid. This was the title that was given to the male descendants of Muhammad. And he would champion the faith of God in his day when he arose. Now the imamate, that is the period in which these 12 imams ruled spiritually in the world, lasted for 260 years. Now you remember the date of the declaration of the Bab in the lunar calendar? What year was it? 1260. So you see, from the disappearance of the 12th Imam until the declaration of the Bab was exactly 1,000 years. And this is referred to in a number of prophecies and so on. Now, after the 12th Imam disappeared, it was said that he disappeared rather than that he died, at that point anyway. There were a series of 4 individuals who were said to have been appointed by him, who succeeded one another and acted as intermediaries with the hidden imam. So he began to be called the hidden imam. And the Muslims actually believe that he still lives somewhere. He hasn't died. He's living in the earth, and he will come out in the time of the end from these hidden cities where he lives, and he will proclaim the religion. And these 4 individuals each had the title of the Bab, or door, or gate. They were the gate to the hidden imam. So when the Bab declared himself to be the Bab, this immediately, in the minds of the people, meant he was the 5th of these doors to this hidden imam, and therefore would have something to say on the part of the hidden imam. But the Bab, in time, made it clear that he was the Babullah, not the Bab of the Qa'im, but he was the gate of God himself, and therefore, as we understand now, a full manifestation of God. Yes?
In connection with this question about the imam, the gaze to the imam,
has not denied... thing made it that.
Do we accept the four paths? Speaking on behalf of the Twelfth Imam.
Yes, I know we accept the four Babs too. They seem to have been, but they're not added to become 14 Imams. It's still 12 Imams, and these were just spokesmen, really. Well, they have prophecies about the Mahdi, a promised one. They believe that Christ will return also, and sometimes those two are connected together, that the Mahdi or the promised one, the return of Christ, will come in the time of the end and lead the resurrection, so to speak. All of this, of course, is a very kind of a general overview that we're talking about tonight. You have to look at the details in proper books and so on. And there's some excellent books for doing such. And this one of these assignments is compiling a list of supplementary reading material. You'll want to find out the best books to read on Islam, if they're available, or if you can get copies of chapters of them from people who have them. It would be excellent background for you. Shia Islam, of course, began among the Arabs, but it flourished the most of all in Persia, in Iran. And not right away, but later on, through the Safavid dynasty. That was in the 16th century. The period of the four Babs was 69 years. With the refusal of either the Imam or the final Bab to name a successor, the matter was to be left by the faithful entirely in the hands of God about who they should follow after that. There was no outward or visible center to which to turn. Now, with regard specifically, we've got a couple historical accounts that are interesting background from two books, one by the hand of the cause Hassan Balyuzi, his book on Baha'u'llah, the King of Glory, and another is an extract from the Revelation of Baha'u'llah by Adib Tarzadi. Now, they're repetitive in some aspects, and we'll repeat some of the earlier things we said, but by hearing it a couple of times, it'll help fix it, I think, more in our minds. Mr. Balyuzi says that the Kitab-e-Ghan, or the Book of Certitude, was written in answer to questions presented by Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, a maternal uncle of the Bab, entitled Khali Akbar. He and his brother, Haji Mirza Hassan Ali, entitled Khali Askar, were visiting the holy shrines of Iraq in the year 1862. Both of them, during the six short, eventful years of the ministry of their nephew, had stood firm and steadfast in his support and defense, but neither of them had given him his allegiance. Baha'u'llah himself relates in a tablet that Haji Sayyid Javadi Karbalai spoke to him, Baha'u'llah, of the presence of these two uncles of the Bab in Iraq. Baha'u'llah then inquired from Haji Sayyid Javad whether he had reminded them of the cause of the Bab. Haji Sayyid Javad had not, and Baha'u'llah related in the tablet that he wished such close relatives of the primal point not to be deprived of the bounties conferred by the faith of their glorious nephew, and he directed Haji Sayyid Javad to bring one or both of them to meet him. Already in Shiraz, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad had been prompted by a relative, Aga Mirza Aga Nuruddin, to travel to Iraq, outwardly on pilgrimage to the holy shrines, but in truth with the aim of attaining the presence of Baha'u'llah. As a youth, Aga Mirza Aga had been converted to the Babi faith by his aunt, Khadija Begum, the wife of the Bab. Now when Haji Sayyid Jawad Karbalai, whom he had known well for many years, brought Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad this invitation from Baha'u'llah, he gladly and readily responded. Baha'u'llah mentions in the same tablet that when he asked Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad what it was that stood in his way, the latter replied that there were some questions which had caused him great concern. Baha'u'llah advised him to write down those questions that they might be answered. In recent years, amongst the papers left by Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, the questions he presented to Baha'u'llah have come to light. These, which we can read today in the handwriting of Haji Sayyid Muhammad himself, are related to the Shia expectations of the advent of the Qa'im of the house or family of Muhammad. Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad worded his questions under four headings, namely, and this is a summary of the types of questions that he asked: the day of resurrection. Is there to be corporeal resurrection? The world is replete with injustice. How are the just to be requited and the unjust punished? 2. The 12th Imam was born in a certain time and lives on. There are traditions all supporting this belief. How can this be explained? 3. Interpretation of the holy texts. This cause does not seem to conform with beliefs held throughout the years. One cannot ignore the literal meaning of holy texts and scripture. How can this be explained? And 4. Certain events, according to the traditions that have come down from the Imams, must occur at the advent of the Qa'im. Some of these are mentioned, but none of these has happened. How can this be explained? This is the gist of the questions presented to Baha'u'llah by the uncle of the Bab. And now you'll see how this matches, how the themes of what Baha'u'llah is saying in the Aghan are addressed to removing the doubts of this uncle with regard to these questions. The study of the hadith, or the sayings of Muhammad, the sayings, traditional sayings of the Imams, as distinct from the revealed verses of the Quran, is a big subject just in itself. Over the centuries, there were contradictory recordings of these sayings. There are a number of them which obviously are not true. We do not accept the validity of any of the sayings of Islam, except those that have been affirmed by one of the central figures of the faith. And they quote a lot of them, and the Aghan contains a number of them. And then we know from the fact that they're cited there that they're accurate. But oftentimes people would spread rumors. Some of the sects and interested political parties would spread rumors, invent new sayings, and create a chain of people who had said to who, who had said to who, who had said to who, that these came down, because there's always this chain of succession of a good, authentic saying. It's supposed to know who said it, who heard it first, and who did they say it to. And if you've got really prestigious listeners and speakers in the line, then it's a more powerful kind of a saying. But these things, sometimes these chains were invented, and there was a lot of bogus hadith literature. And some of these amazing, miraculous things that are supposed to be done by the Imam are within that literature. In Adib Tarzadi's book, he says Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad was so affected by meeting Baha'u'llah that he immediately wrote a letter to his son, Haji Mirza Muhammad Taqi, in which he said the following: I attained the presence of His Honor Baha, may peace be upon him, and I wish you could have been present. He treated me with the utmost affection and favor, and graciously asked me to stay for the night. It is an absolute truth that deprivation from His bounteous presence is a grievous loss. May God bestow upon me the privilege of attaining His presence perpetually. The Aghan dispelled every doubt that Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad had harbored in his mind. As a result of reading this book, he reached the stage of certitude and recognized the station of the Bab. In his will, written some years later, he declared his faith, acknowledged the authenticity of the messages of the Bab and Baha'u'llah, and identified himself as a follower of these twin manifestations of God. Now we have a few notes with regard to the manuscript of the Aghan. There's three extracts here containing various facts regarding the history and fate of the original copy of the Aghan itself that was given into the hands of Haji Mirza Muhammad. From Adib Tarzadi's book, he says the original copy of the Aghan, which Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad received, was transcribed by Abdul Baha, who was then 18 years of age. In the margins of a few pages, Baha'u'llah has in his own hand made some corrections. And towards the end of the book, he has written a passage in the margin, and this is the passage. He says, amidst them all, this is Baha'u'llah's added amendment to the Higan, amidst them all we stand life in hand, wholly resigned to his will, that perchance through God's loving kindness and his grace, this revealed and manifest letter may lay down his life as a sacrifice in the path of the primal point, the most exalted word. By him at whose bidding the Spirit hath spoken. But for this yearning of our soul, we would not for one moment have tarried any longer in this city. Sufficient witness is God unto us. For many years, this original copy of the Igan remained with the family of Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, until in 1948 his great-granddaughter, Fatime Khanume Afnan, presented it to Shoghi Effendi, the guardian of the faith. It reached him a few years later and was placed in the Baha'i International Archives building on Mount Carmel. And in Mr. Balyuzi's book, he says, Baha'u'llah revealed the Kitab-i Igan answering the questions posed by this uncle of the Bab within 48 hours. The original manuscript in the handwriting of Abdul Baha with marginal additions by Baha'u'llah himself is now preserved, as we know, here in Mount Carmel. Fatime Khanume Afnan, a great granddaughter of Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, had inherited this manuscript, and she presented it to the guardian of the Baha'i faith. A copy which must have been transcribed for Haji Mirza Hassan Ali, the junior uncle of the Bab, who, although he did not accompany his brother into the presence of Baha'u'llah, before long gave him also his allegiance, bears a date only 1 year after its revelation. It is now in the possession of one of Haji Mirza Hassan Ali's great-great-grandsons. The Book of Certitude was perhaps the earliest of the writings of Baha'u'llah to appear in print. A beautifully lithographed copy, which does not bear a date, must have been printed in Bombay and is known to have been in circulation in the early 80s of the last century. This is one of the very early publications. Now, Dr. G. Carey throws additional light on this whole question of the arrival of this original manuscript, which hadn't been in the Holy Land, and which the Shoghi Effendi didn't have, really, among the archival materials here. And when Dr. G. Carey was on a visit here, Mr. Khadim had come from Persia and had brought with him the Igan that had been given by the relative of the Bab after so many years. He says in his Book of Recollections about Shoghi Effendi, which is a superb book and especially interesting, I think, to people who are serving here, if you have a chance to find it and read it. It's called Shoghi Effendi Recollections by Dr. Ugo Giacchieri. He says, I should like to mention an episode. Excuse me. I should like to mention an episode which further demonstrates the eager interest of Shoghi Effendi in collecting information and facts pertaining to the sacred writings and the history of the cause. One evening, as I entered the dining room, the guardian was already seated at his place at the table, his face shining with an inner jubilation which he could neither control nor conceal. At his side, upon the table, stood a small bundle, an object wrapped in a colored silk handkerchief, typical of the East and of Iran in particular. As soon as we were all seated and attentive, even before dinner was served, he said that a pilgrim had that day arrived from Tehran, bringing with him one of the most precious documents to be placed in the archives. He untied the handkerchief and with great reverence lifted out a manuscript in book form, and placing it in a position that everyone could see, added that it contained two original tablets in the handwriting of Abdul Baha. One was the Igan, and the other was a tablet, the name of which I do not now remember. These manuscripts, Shoghi Effendi stated, were transcribed by Abdul Baha in his beautiful calligraphy when he was about 18 years old. and bore some additions in the hand of Baha'u'llah, insertions which he had written on the margins of many pages in reviewing the manuscripts. Shoghi Effendi had never before seen the original of the Iqran and was deeply astonished to discover that the phrase he had chosen from this book and placed on the title page of his translation of Nabil's narrative, The Dawnbreakers, was an after-reflection of Baha'u'llah's written by himself on the margin of one page. And this is that quote that I read to you earlier, I stand life in hand, ready that perchance I could. This is that section was chosen. It's been placed at the front of the Dawnbreakers. And now Shoghi Effendi found this was in Baha'u'llah's own hand as an afterthought added in. The guardian that evening was not only astonished but overjoyed as well, because he was conscious that through a mysterious process he had been inspired to adopt that phrase as an eternal testimonial to Baha'u'llah's yearning to sacrifice his life for the Bab, the primal point. All of us were seated at the table, all of us who were seated at the table were awed and profoundly stirred, and I in particular felt that the existence of a spiritual link between the guardian and the invisible world of God was something that no one should ever doubt. Within some 130 years of its revelation now, renderings have been made thus far into 28 languages of the Iqran. I'm going to read these languages for you just to give you an idea. Baha'u'llah appears in the world even though the faith is not spread to even 1% of humanity as yet, but still we have this work that the Baha'is have done in translating the Iqran, and Shoghi Effendi was very interested in these kind of things and used to collect and keep the lists of the translation of all the major writings of the faith, because it would show the universality of the cause. It's translated now into Afrikaans, Albanian, Armenian, Arabic. You recall it was in Persian, it's been translated to Arabic, Bengali, Bulgarian, Burmese, Chinese, Czech, Danish, Dutch Flemish, English, English Braille, Esperanto, French, German, Gujarati, Japanese, Kurdish, Norwegian, Portuguese, Russian, Serbian, Shona, that's the South African language, Spanish, Swedish, Turkish, Urdu, and Xhosa, also another South African language. Now, if you know of any further ones, let me know, because I want to add them to the list. 28 of them there so far. So this introduction, as I said earlier, gives us an idea of what we need to, what the attitude we should take towards the Islamic references in the book. And there are a number of notes and different references which will help an understanding of those passages. And some of those we'll be able to treat in successive classes when we review the text. If you have any as you're reading through the book that you want to note down, you could save them and we'll bring them up. I would be interested in questions that you have that might not get answered in class, but that you'd like to have answered, because I've collected this manuscript over the years of 3-4 of these courses, and the American Publishing Trust has asked to publish it, and they're doing some editing on it now, and it should be out sometime, perhaps towards the end of this year. So next week, we'll be looking back at these notes from the that I handed out last week. If you begin to look for the subject matter of these various topics, we can look at those, and also something about understanding the divine texts and prerequisites. And then we'll start to, I think, also deal with some of these questions from the fourth lesson here. which are those passages cited in the dispensation and the gleanings, and reflect a little bit on the importance that they may have, the indications they may have for us about what are the most significant sections or passages of the Iggan, and might suggest to us which of those passages we should concentrate on mastering, perhaps memorizing. So look forward to discussing those things next week. Thank you.